Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Okay, so we continue with our examination of peace as ordered to our examination of war. And the reason why we're spending 2 days yesterday and today on peace is because war is a result of a certain privation. There's only three principles of being: potency, act, privation. Or I should say those are the most fundamental. And we can't understand something that is sought as a good under the formal active sense unless, or we can't understand a privation, an absence of a due good, unless we understand the good. So the peace is at the heart. War will be unintelligible without some conception of peace. And just to remind us where we're going and why this is important, and the dynamics of war are so unique, is because we have within reality that God has made, according to the eternal law, how God knows the world to be, we have anything that is a nature. There's no such thing as a natureless being. To describe even a being as natureless per impossibile would be to commit an impossibility, because you'd be defining, giving a definition that corresponds to something when you say that that something has no definition, no essence, no form to correspond to. So meaning and shape and form and act, essence, shapes the nature of everything from the highest angel, God himself, all the way down to the lowest, smallest subatomic particle. Then that order is recognizable in sensate being, sensitive being, animal being, non-rational animal, sensitive being. And it's also present in rational beings. And then obviously, because it originates, as we're going to see today, when we look at Aquinas' commentary on Dionysius' Pseudo-Dionysius' De Divinis Nominibus, on the divine names, God. Order, 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 order. The orderer. The end. There's no such thing as a being without an end. God has ordained, makes things to be what they are, and there's an order amongst them. And this is where peace, as we saw, follows the inclinations, the appetites, the desire for goodness on the level of nature, on the level of sensitive nature, on the level of rational nature, and on the level of God. And what happens with war, as we generally conceive of it, is war is taking place here, where you have war amongst various rational beings, whether they be one nation versus another, one person versus another. Even the celestial hierarchies, you know, we talk about angelic combat, that's where we typically place it. And that's true, but as we'll see, Aquinas understands war and conflict as able to permeate all of these various levels of appetition or appetite. And why is this important? It's important because we will not fully appreciate what Aquinas says about war and conflict if we don't understand the intrinsic, teleological, nature-based inclinations towards the good of being. So just war is not, again, rules. This is how we've all decided as good people, common sense, to get along. Aquinas' conception of just war is grounded in the order of reality, as ordered to the good, as called to rest in that good, particularly with the rational creatures. But everything from the lowest subatomic particle to the highest angel is ordered in their being to goodness and to peace. And therefore, unless we see that peace is intrinsic, because good and peace go together because of the appetite, unless we appreciate the ontological, inherent, constitutive orientation of every being, no matter what they are, towards the good, war becomes less intelligible, because what is happening with war is that we have a apparent privation. We are looking for peace, we are looking for the good, and we have conflictive principles, persons, groups, who are trying to achieve what is the same end, good, but differently. Some perhaps erroneously, some perhaps correctly, and some perhaps neither erroneously or correctly, just differently. Okay? So that's the main point. Aquinas does not have a concept of war as a positivistic thing about rules. So he's not saying that war is something like, well, if you're going to do it in this way. This will be less bad. No, the motivation for war, the regrettability of war, and the resolution of war are only intelligible if we understand the fundamental principles of being, which lead to war, and therefore shape, restrict, specify, and make precise how war ought to be done. Because remember, as he said, we saw yesterday, everyone fights for the sake of peace, which means for the sake of good, which means for the sake of our inclinations, which means for the sake of who we are. Okay? So again, just war categories as free-floating ideas out there. That's a modern thing. That does not exist for Aquinas, because Aquinas is consecrated to reality. That's what he is. He's looking at the way things are, and knowing where the principle of things are comes from God. Okay. Now, some of you have already opined, and I apologize for this. The divine names in the commentary is a little, shall we say, elusive. As often his commentaries, particularly on philosophers and theologians, even sometimes the biblical, all of his stuff can be a little elusive. But there was a recent translation done of the De Divinis Nominibus by a Thomas Aquinas College professor, published by St. Thomas More College. But I didn't want you to buy that. So, oh, good, we have it online here. Except, in that translation, it's a very literal translation, but there are some infelicities which come. And as I was looking at it, basically, yeah, here it is. You read this, and I checked it out a little while ago, and I was like, oh, these poor people. sorry about that. And what I've given you today has, in brackets, modifications that might elucidate our understanding. Sometimes I've included the Latin for Father Hofer just so we can verify things, but also you can see. So again, I'm not criticizing this translation online. This was a heroic act of generosity by a very gifted young scholar. But I apologize, because I just assumed it was fine, and I didn't want to say, hey, buy this $60 book to read this one chapter. So this is taken from what you have with modifications, okay? All right. Looking number one. Something properly is said to have peace in itself from the fact that its appetite rests in its proper good attained. By proper, here we mean the good that's proportioned to it, that fits it, that suits it, that is perfective of it. Which indeed happens. The appetite rests in its proper good attained, which indeed happens when there is not anything repugnant, contradictory, either interior or exterior, that impedes such rest. We recall what we looked at earlier. This is him, obviously, the repugnance would correspond to dissension, interior or exterior conflict of orders. The goal of peace is to rest in its proper good, and therefore peace is attained when there's not interior within the acting agent, the one who's acting, or exterior from others. There's no obstacles. So there's a unity and integrality of the individual, and also of the individual with other individuals, other cultures, other individualities. Okay. And therefore, something is said to have peace for itself and for others from a certain union, coming together, integration, union, by which every repugnance is excluded. All obstacles to peace are excluded. Which union indeed is understood here in the name of, and here's the first thing, of gathering, we could say congregation, of gathering, congregationis, when he says, the author of the divine name, says that we ought to praise the divine peace, which is the principal cause of gathering. So when Aquinas, he's identifying the definition of peace, what it is, what's opposed to it, dissension, repugnant principles, either internal or external. And then he goes and says, what is the principal cause? It's the divine peace, which is God himself. He is the one from which principle, he's the chief cause of the gathering, of union. Because, I say, we do not suffice to praise this divine peace according as it is in itself, it is necessary that we should praise it with peaceful hymns, that is, with praises taken from this, that it makes peace in things. So every being that exists in Aquinas' conception of peace, we can say stands between peace and peace. What do we mean by that? We can say on the one side of a being, it stands between peace because its being, its nature, its order, and all of its various levels of ontological density are ordered to the good. You're made, created for, designed for, searching for, irrevocably, peace. That's what you are. To exist is to be ordered to the good, to peace. And then all of our actions, all of our searching for the cultivation on peace through our operations, through second act, ultimately must terminate in God, because God, the first cause, is the one who gave us that. And therefore, because he gave us peace and he is the fullness of peace, when we search for peace, whether we know it or not, we are searching for God. Footnote, this is not divine revelation yet. And by that, I mean, we're not in the order of faith. This is something that even a philosopher without faith, the Bible, sacred tradition, could know. This is what we said earlier, day one. God is both the natural and the supernatural end of the human person. God is natural and is what all beings desire as cause of their existence, something a philosopher can identify, even if it's with difficulty, mixed with errors and over time. And the supernatural end is super peace, when God shows us his private life, his inner self, the beatific vision, Trinitarian communion. So we are ordered to God both to peace naturally as effects to a cause, but also supernaturally, which is from not just a cause, but a Redeemer, Trinitarian Lord God drawing us to himself. Okay, so just so you know, we're not jumping straight into theology. This Aquinas thinks this is written into the DNA, metaphysical DNA of everything that exists. But of course, the most interesting one, particularly for our inquiry, is not the rock. It's not our puppy. Puppies are great. Cats are great. I'm more of a cat person. But it's rational creatures. And notice that it builds up. Rational animals, us, we have also a sensitive nature. We have feelings in the body. We get hungry. We get nervous. We get scared. And we also have a nature that fundamentally exists and is ordered to good. So within the rational nature, these various other teleologies, orders to good, are included. So that's what number two is important here. Whereas, because rightly, the name of peace, the word peace, is most used more frequently in rational creatures. We don't usually walk outside and say, you know, that rock is such a peaceful rock. You could, if you were rather pedantic and bother people because you always were trying to be deep. We don't usually say that. But if we see a person, we do describe them as peaceful. Peace is usually predicated of, said of, a rational being. And we're just, when I say rational beings, I'm meaning here human persons, although angels are rational persons as well, but of angelic nature. Okay. So the name peace is used more frequently in rational creatures, in which the ratio of peace. And remember, ratio can be many things, often left untranslated because of its flexibility. It can be notion, definition, nature, reason, concept. In whom the ratio of peace is more manifestius found. So he says that the nature, the ratio of peace is found more clearly in rational creatures. From them, it must be considered what peace properly is and in what the ratio of peace consists. For this is what the divine peace effectively produces in things. Now, why is it, before we go on, that the ratio, the most robust, augmented, complete sense of peace in the created order, the contingent order, not God, is found in rational creatures? It's because two reasons. One, we could call on the order of being, and also the second on the order of knowing. So on the order of being, every human person with a rational nature has a nature, has sensitive being, and has a rational soul. So they have this in their single suppositional nature, their being. I'm a single human person. I have all three of these degrees of being, and therefore all three of these degrees of peace orientation, just in being. But secondly, as a rational creature, I don't just have the orientation to peace passively. I'm just, you know, what are you doing? I'm moving towards the peace, you know. No. But rational creatures can exercise rationality, because what is reason? It's the helicopter power that can look into things. It's able to understand nature as ordered to a good and therefore to peace. Sensitive being, emotions, bodily need as ordered to material, contingent, particular goods, and the peace that is proper to them. It can even look at itself, rationality. I'm ordered to all goods, the will, rational appetite, all goods. And it can even understand, approximate God as good and as peace. So that's why the ratio of peace is chiefly located on this level, because it doesn't just have peace passively in its existence, but it's also active. We can know formally and deliberately the order of things, the goodness of things, and the peace that all things search for irrevocably. Okay? That's why he puts the emphasis on rationality here. Rocks also participate in a peaceful order, an order to the good, but they don't know that. We both participate in an order to the good just by existing, and we can know that we are participating in order to the good in our operations. Okay? That's the unique dignity of rational beings. They both are ordered, and they can know that they are so ordered. So we have a double participation, passive and active. Okay. Yet any men, are said to have peace when their wills harmonize in one. Why the will again? Because that's the appetite of reason. That's the appetite of the intellect, which is able to look at all types of being, therefore all types of goodness, therefore all types of order to goodness, and can the will, the appetite of reason, can therefore desire that. And not just us, or me, you, as individuals, but we can be united in emotion towards true goodness and therefore peace. Peace is not mutually exclusive. And for thus, one is not opposed to another. Yet, that many harmonize in one happens from the fact that they communicate in someone, that they share it. For example, those who communicate in one city harmonize unto the common good of the city. There's some good that we all participate in, that is the principle of our unity. And something similar is clear in other things. And therefore, he says, two things concur under the ratio of peace. So he's giving us the two elements that constitute the ratio, the notion of peace. First, that some things are united. And second, that they harmonize unto one. So he says, with peace, you have two dimensions. You have, it can be like a triangle. You have thing one and thing two. The first element of peace, we'll call that A, is whenever you have a convergence of at least two things into one. And the second dimension, we can say that B is their point of union. Okay? So this we can say with respect to first act, the existence of various respective beings. And this is second act, where through their operations, their actions, their intentions, they are united in someone. Okay. And according to this, he keeps coming back to this. This is the third line from the bottom. Peace also is said in natural things. Right there. Good. Although some things are discordant as regards their proper ends, nevertheless, all things harmonize in the appetite of the last end. Saying all things, whether the subatomic particle, the cat, the tree, the dog, the wind, everything is ordered, harmonized in its orientation up here, even if there are respective elements of their individual natures which are different. So, for example, here, just to give a quick example, it's like heat, hot, and cold. Those are opposite. And yet, the dynamics of hot and cold, even as distinct, are still collectively ordered to the same, their principle, their cause. Okay? That's what he's saying. All right. Number three. Then when he says, and Aquinas here speaking of the author of the Divinis Nominibus, on account of which all things desire it, he shows how, now he jumps up here, says, okay, if God orders all things, God is divine peace. He jumps up to the principle, to the cause. He shows how the divine peace is the final cause. That's just code for the end, the goal, the destination. Is the final cause of all things. Yet it is natural to whatever thing that it should desire unity as also being and good. Here, of course, it's the transcendentals. He's identifying for the metaphysician the fact that we can recognize in being and any type of being that there's that there is being and there is goodness, but that there's also the unitive element. Something is good as a whole. We're going to see that in a little bit. But also that it moves towards, in its operations, not just in its existence, towards unity. Which, of course, looking at will be briefly overviewed on Monday in charity, is germane to peace. Yet any men are said to have peace when their wills harmonize with one. The divine peace is the cause of all. Yet it is natural that... Okay, good. Because through division, a thing fails and is corrupted, and goodness is lessened for a thing. Through division, a thing fails and is corrupted, and goodness is lessened in a thing. Aquinas' point here is that you can have two types of division. You can have what we can call intrinsic division, where these one and two things begin to disintegrate. And you can also have division between these two things vis-a-vis a common end, okay? This, both of these divisions, disintegrations, disunities are contrary to the nature of peace. And because the divine peace causes unity in things, for this reason, he, the author that Aquinas comments upon, concludes that all things in their way desire, appetite the divine peace. Inasmuch as it is also unitive of all things, because it's the final end. And this is what he says, their divisible multitude converting to the whole unity. Namely, because those things that are divided in themselves are united in a whole, inasmuch as they are parts of the universal. And likewise, inasmuch as above he said that it is the generative and operative consensus and connaturality, connaturality, we saw that earlier, to which there responds what is added here, and the natural war of things, of a thing, for a natural war for a thing, unifying unto conformed cohabitation. For those things that naturally fight one another, combative language again, on account of the contrariety that they have in their proper natures, harmonized in the universal order. What is Aquinas doing here? This is where it gets very elusive. I felt bad when I saw this. This talks about war and peace. Good, I'll send this out. And I was looking, I'm like, yeah, this is not easy going. What is the dynamic that Aquinas is engaging here? He's engaging the fact that how is it that things can be different? We're not all identical. The rock is not the tree, which is not the bird, which is not St. Gabriel, the archangel. There is difference, which implies disunity. And yet, all of us, because every different type of being is ordered according to the wisdom, the eternal law of God, having a nature that is reflective in some way, a contingent way of God's own knowledge and being, how is it that you can have difference and unity in beings and in their cohesive operation? Okay, that's the problem that's underlying what Aquinas is doing here. And that's why he speaks about the natural war. That's a little, you know, he cites the author of this book. The natural war, that's just the very fact that a rock and a tree are different, yet they both are. How do we, you know, there's differences here. Okay. So, for those things that naturally fight one another on account of the contrariety that they have in their proper natures, harmonize in the universal order, the common good. That's the locus of unity. Aquinas is going to argue and demonstrate, indeed, that respective individual differences do not compromise the common good of the universe. And here we don't just mean the political common good, but the cosmological common good. According to which, but the political common good follows from the cosmological, okay? So because we act rationally because we exist in a common good. All right, so I'm not denying the political common good. According to which, in a certain way, they are united and dwell together in the world. And this is from the participation of the divine peace, that inasmuch as it is desired by all things, divine peace, has the ratio of an end. So what he's saying is, because we have differences, it would seem that peace is elusive, and indeed it can be. However, because God, the divine peace, orders all things as the good to himself, smallest subatomic particle to the highest reality, but because of B, which in this case is God, all things desire and are ordered to him. There is a unity to the whole of reality, fundamentally in being. All right, number four. Yet it must be considered that as with the other perfections proceeding from God, the supreme creatures, again, rational creatures and angels, participate those more abundantly than other things, such that through them they can be derived in a certain way to the lowest things. Therefore, he says that the supreme creatures are worthier from the number of gathering virtues. I suggest it's the congregating powers, the Latin I include there. Namely, because they participate the gathering of the divine peace in so great an abundance that they might also be gathering of others. For each of these powers, through the participation of the divine peace, has a threefold union. So because human rationality in its existence and in its operation, it exists as ordered and it knows that it's ordered, he says we can talk about rational creatures can understand and participate in the order of peace in three ways. First, they participate in the divine peace, one of which indeed is to themselves, according as each of these, according to itself, is some one thing. So he says, first of all, the first type of peace we can see reflected in us is that I am one. I exist in some unified way. I don't say we, unless I have a psychological problem. I say I, because that reflects that I have a unity here. He says that reflects the divine peace first. Second, whereas another union is according as one is united to another in the order of the truly one. So he says, not only is there unity reflective of the divine peace in me, myself, but also in me, myself, in relation to you, yourself. That's the second type of peace that is reflective of the divine peace, divine goodness. And then thirdly, the union that is according to which they are united to one principle of the peace of all things, and that is God. So there's three locus, loci of peace, and all of them bespeak the divine wisdom and the divine goodness. All right. Number five. Now we're to St. Augustine again. Beautiful. Yet unity of peace consists in tranquility of order, in tranquillitate ordinis, as Augustine says in the City of God. And so now he's going to explain, what is this tranquility of order which is reflected in our participations in the divine peace? How does divine peace look in created reality? It's in the tranquility of order. What does that entail? Here he defines it. First, that they be distinguished from one another. Notice this, for there cannot be an order unless of distinct things. He turns the argument in wisdom on its head. The argument initially was, well, there can be no real unity because they're different. Difference is opposed to unity. He says, but if peace is the tranquility of order, you can't have order unless you have difference. Because something technically is not ordered to itself. Good. Asterisk there, we could go on to explain that. There's God is ordered to himself, but we're not going to get into that for the moment. Okay. So, individuality is not inimical to peace, because individuality and individualities, in order to have order, you have to have a plurality. Second, it is necessary for tranquility of order that none of the distinct things should go out of the limits of its nature.
And to this, there pertains what he says, bounds, terminates. What does this mean? He says, so he's doubling down now on individuality in parts as important for order. So not only does he say you need individuals that are distinct to be united, but you need individuals that are truly what they are consistently. You can't have true order if everything which is changing. That's a soup. That's a mess. So the deliberate and consistent remaining within the bounds, the terms, the context of your nature, doubling down on your individuality, your specificity, that too is significant for peace. So in other words, you wouldn't have real peace if you brought one and two together and now you got a tertium quid, a third thing. That's not true peace. You can have one and two coming together in another good, but they must, in order to have true tranquility, must have retained what they are. Because the order would not remain. If you didn't have, if one and two disappeared when they came together, that wouldn't be peaceful. That wouldn't be an order. That would just be a disintegration of two and a creation of one. I'm very tempted now to go into Marxism again and all the principles, you know, but I will not. This is what they're trying to do, dialectics. Okay, third. There is required from this definition, tranquility of order, and termination, boundary should be stabilized. It should consist, stability. There must be a maintaining in a firm way the nature, the ratio of individuals. Otherwise, skipping there for the sake of time to the semicolon, otherwise, if the definition and termination or boundary of things were not secure or firm, but one thing going out from its term or boundary were to invade the ends, limits of another, the order of things would be confused or confounded, and thus there would be no tranquility of order. So the first thing he's done here in our number five is he says, there must be a distinction in order to have peace. That's the main point. He's looking at it in a rather exhaustive, and some might even say exhausting way. Okay. How does this apply to the order of reality? Number six. Nothing is so low, ita infimum, in things that it does not participate in any divine gift, from which participation it obtains, that it should have connatural, second nature, friendship for other creatures, and that it should be ordered to God as to a last end, which is to enjoy God. So he reminds us again, what we've just said here applies to all the subatomic particles, all the orders of being, individuality, and ordination, order to God. Number seven. Let's go back to divine peace, the principle, the cause. For the divine peace itself proceeds to all things, according as through its likeness it hands itself on to all things, according to, this was translated propriety, I would say specific capacity of each thing. So you and I, as rational creatures, participate in, reflect the divine peace, the divine goodness, in a way that is higher than the stone, even though we both do, because you and I have greater capacities than the stone. Okay? And nevertheless, it, the divine peace, superflows, very literal translation, I'd say overflows, according to the abundance of peaceful fecundity. Any of you have had Father Giertych at the Angelicum, that's one of his favorite words to say, fecundity. Namely, because there is more of power in God for making peace than there is in things the capacity for receiving peace. Because God is infinite goodness, because God, therefore, is infinite peace, there is more goodness and peace in the divine peace than any of these three contingent created levels can receive. And for this reason, the emanation of peace from God is above every receptibility, receptive capacity of a thing. That's because we have potency. And all the reception of peace is according to the capacity of things, since the divine peace so proceeds to all things according to the emanation of effects. Nevertheless, this flows immobile in itself, the whole supereminently united to whole, because there is no diversity of parts there which could impede the whole from being united to the whole. What is he talking about? He's saying that there's no motion in God. God is not searching for peace. Pure act.
He's united to himself. He has complete goodness, complete perfection. There are no parts in him. Parts imply imperfection of some sort because there's distance. There's none of that in God. What Aquinas is doing is showing, well, he showed the requirements and the dynamics of peace for us as creatures. He's going back to the unity, the sublimity, the infinity of God as pure act to show us what the origin of our participated and limited and diverse peace looks like. This is one, this is infinite, this is eternal, this is God. And now we get to the juicy question, which we're, I have to be, I'm not going to be as good in time, I will, but we're going to, I'm not as good as I was yesterday. I know we have 9 minutes. All right. Therefore, he asks first, the author asks, Aquinas, how? How can it be said that all things desire peace, since there are many that rejoice in the fact that they are others, discrete, separate, individual from others, and do not wish to rest spontaneously in their proper things? But these things always desire to be moved. They don't want to come to a terminal point, it would seem. They always want to be moving. Yet since the ratio of peace, the nature, the definition of peace, consists in unity and in rest. Unity, because of us, this coming together. Rest, because they both arrive here. All these things seem to be opposed to the ratio, the nature, the definition of peace. So this is a good objection. Hey, I don't know. It seems like, you know, there's a lot going on. We're not seeing peace. A lot of people, they're just on the way. Things on the way. I'm not seeing a lot of rest. All right, for the sake of time, okay, there's a lot. You can look at, let's skip to 10. We might come back to 9. Skip to number 10. It pertains to the providence of God, the eternal law, his wisdom, reflected in being creatures. It pertains to the providence of God, according as it makes peace in things, that it should exclude war from things, which is opposed to peace. Yet there would be war in things unless confusion were removed, because one thing would not be contained within its proper limits, but in a certain way would invade those of others. And therefore, through the fact that divine providence preserves all things not warring and unconfused, and each thing to itself, and diverse things to another, it establishes, providence establishes peace in this. And this is what he adds, that providence, it, establishes all things according to the stability, I would say, and unsubsiding power unto its peace and immobility. That is, so that they might retain immobility in their proper natures and so have peace for God, peace for themselves. Okay, what is he saying here? He is saying that the objection, the concern was things are not actually going to arrive. It would seem not all things are order or actually attain a rest, an immobility. Everything's dialectically opposed, moving, rubbing against, flicting. Cultures, societies, histories, narratives, viewpoints, perspectives are all in battle. There seems to be a great dynamism, or a dynamism present to the at the expense of immobility coming to a point of rest. And he says, well, what we're looking at, he reminds us, is actually that there's two types of immobility. There's two types of rest. One is the type of rest of what the philosophers call second act, when I do something. But there's another type of rest and immobility which comes from the fact that I exist and what I am, and that's consistent and that perdures. So he says, he's trying to identify in the very being of all things, there is a form of immobility insofar as you have that firmness and that consistency in your very nature and in your very existence. And from that first existential being immobility, then you have actional, operational immobility, which happens when you arrive at the good. So what's fascinating, his move, he's trying to say, yes, immobility ultimately here is what all things seek, but he shows that even in the very constitution of the beings, which would seemingly have no peace, they have peace reflective of God who made them, reflective of divine peace, the principle of all peace, because he made them and they are consistently what they are. So he's equating here a certain stability with a certain nascent immobility. Okay? And so number 11, the distinctiveness of all mobile and motive things is conserved by the divine peace. God is the author of each individual nature for their differences. Therefore, differences are not opposed to peace. He's trying to break down the absolute dialectic which exists in the minds of his audience or in our minds. He says, no. Peace has to comprise all the dynamics of being and action, being individual beings and their unified action. Distinctiveness is not an obstacle to this. God's the principle of all things, things that exist, and the principles of their operation through physical premotion, but we won't get into that now. Okay, number 12. Nothing totally falls from this unition of peace. Ab unitione pace, you could say union of peace. Yet each thing desires and loves what is conformed to itself, yet flees the contrary. For it is impossible that there should be any being which totally flees unition or union and desires otherness and discretion, which is according to a fall from natural peace. It is impossible that there should be any being which totally flees union and desires otherness and discretion. And discretion here doesn't mean keeping the secrets, but it means your individuality. So he's keeping the balance. He's emphasizing, yes, individuality is significant. You have a nature, it's consistent, it has terms, limits, boundaries, and that's good, because unless you have that, you can't have peace. But he also saying, this individuality, this discrete nature, this is not absolute, such that the orientation of this number one is not in on itself, but is always as a one ordered to unity. Okay? That's what Aquinas, he's trying to go through all of the principles and show how they integrate within the reality of peace. Number 13. Then when he says, yet if he says that those make enemies, back to enemies, he solves the doubt according to the third understanding, such that what has been said, colon, that there are many things that rejoice over otherness and discretion. So now we're getting second, okay, St. Thomas, but still there's a lot of people that get a little giddy when chaos begins. There are many things that rejoice over otherness and discretion might not be referred to natural appetite as in the preceding, but to voluntary appetite. So there's a possible objection. Thomas, this is all very clever. You're a very smart Italian guy. And yet, and I see what you're saying, but I'm still looking around. There are people that kind of like, you know, this is the Joker from, you know, The Dark Knight. Sometimes you just gotta, you know, start chaos. What are you talking about here, Thomas? Our empirical data seems to counteract what you've just argued. And he says, well, I'm laying the principles of being, the natural appetite. What you're pointing to in the Joker, that's a problem here. Rational appetite. And how you're integrating and operating according to natural, sensitive, and rational appetition. That's all beings have peace in their existence and in their collective integration. That can't be contravened, but you can have disorder here, rational appetite. And notice that's where we're going. That's why this is the context. Okay. And he says that if he who raises the doubt should say that those men make enemies with peace and its goods, who rejoice in exterior quarrels, and interior disturbances of mind that he calls furies, which too pertain to the contrary division of peace. And again, they rejoice over variations and instabilities, which seem to be contrary to peace. And this is regards the second part of the doubt. It must be said that such men also are detained by the desire of peace according to a certain obscure likeness. What is he saying here? He is saying, even if you have the Joker, who seems to be the agent of chaos, who likes to disrupt, burn, destroy, be different, contrarian, even, and that's a problem of the voluntary, the will, what he's saying is because being precedes our action, even the Joker, in a very disordered and confused way, can't escape the good orientation, peaceful direction of his nature. So what he's done in this argument, the objector in our mind says, well, it seems like there's a lot of disorder here, no peace. Aquinas reduces this locus of rationality back to rationality has a nature, participates, and all being insofar as it is ordered to goodness and therefore to peace. So he's basically saying the people that live here are existing in a contradiction. And they can't, they're greatly confused about what peace looks like and how to attain it. And even the Joker is searching for peace in a very backwards way. Okay, we're almost done. Where does this come from? Number 14. And he manifests this thus. Again, he here being Pseudo-Dionysius, the author of the De Divinis Nominibus. For such men are assaulted by, much by the passions. Bam! Right here. And you see this with the Joker. Going from angry, charming, manipulative, sincere, dishonest always. This is the principle. He's going, continuing to, why is there disorder on the level of rational appetition? Disordered passions, by which they are disturbed. And thus, through passions of this sort, their interior peace is disturbed. Why? Because you're not just an intellectual soul. You're a being that comprises natural existence, sensitive existence, rational existence. Therefore, from the desire of peace, they wish to allay the assault of passions of this sort, not wisely, but stupidly. The puppies are going crazy. Someone's barking at the doorman. One's trying to eat the cake on the coffee table. He said, don't eat. And the intellect and the will are like, what do? They're trying to render peace on the level of the passions, but they're doing it in a way that's foolish, disordered. Why is it foolish? It's because those that follow the sense appetites, their emotions, the desires for food, drink, and sex, fundamentally, without rationality, are letting the lower power guide the higher power. For they think that they can have an interior peace by fulfilling their superfluous and inordinate desires that are elicited, incited according to various passions. If I just give the dogs what the, yeah, bite the mailman. Yes, eat that cake. We'll have peace. But through this, they are perturbed more. Not just biting the mailman, but he's biting you now. He's not just eating the cake, he's eating the couch. While they cannot obtain the delights by which they are destined, for it is impossible that a man subject to superfluous and inordinate desires should be able to obtain all his desires. And for this reason, quarrels disturb such men seeking peace so that they might fulfill their desires. And because they are subject to various desires, they rejoice over variations. Why is it fundamentally, we're almost done here, just why is it that following the sense appetites always leads to disintegration? It's because, again, the good, this property of the sense appetite is an individual. And individuals, by definition, are distinct. So I'm living by desires for food, drink, and sex as my final ends. Every food, drink, and sexual partner is an individual. It's an individual encounter. And so I'm literally torn apart while the intellect is able to recognize legitimate and good desires and yet integrate them into a single unified end, which does exceed the human capacity, the human dignity, but yet we have the real capacity to participate in it. Sense appetitional movements are good, but if you live by them, your fundamental orientation is downward and apart. So recall, here he's focusing in what we looked at in the Summa, the integration, the peace within and without. Obviously, war we're looking at without, but they're related. And because they are subject to various desires, they rejoice over variations. This occurs in all vicious people. There's no such thing as a faithful adulterer, fornicator. There's no such thing as, it's just, you can look at it, just very clear, very clear. Variation, difference. Number 15. Yet wisely, so not stupidly, yet wisely, would they allay this assault of the passions if, repressing many desires, they were to be converted to the one desire of true peace. All right, in 10 seconds, what Aquinas has done is establish the ontological, and we could call psychological, because of the psyche, for peace from God in the definition of being. Why there's disruptions of peace, even on the level of rationality. And by practical implication, that could be much provocative, I would propose that the more we have problems in culture on the level of sense appetite, unchastity, intemperance, anger, cancel culture. There's going to be bigger problems up here, and we could have more wars in the future because of sins against temperance and fortitude. So now, tomorrow, we'll get to here, but now we've done all the groundwork, we can begin to appreciate what Aquinas does in the Summa.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.